I was called to be there. Since that time, one of the secrets to life I've learned is that every person of every age wants the same things as those boys. If you're a senior executive, when a 35-year-old executive walks into your office, the main thing he or she wants from you as a leader is to love, care, believe, and show him or her how to live better. If you're going to be a great leader, your success is directly connected to these things. When you can incorporate them, you'll get people to do what they otherwise would not do without your presence. So often we miss opportunities to make a difference this way. My time at McKinley taught me you can make a difference as a leader anytime and anywhere. Even the smallest acts of encouragement and kindness can make a huge difference in the lives of the people around you. This is the ultimate definition of leadership. 5. Repetition, repetition, repetition. Leadership is not about saying new things to old people. It's about saying old things to new people. Too often as a leader, we try too hard to come up with new things to say to our team. The fact is that great leaders are willing to repeat themselves over and over again. I call this suffering from leadership fatigue because you get tired of hearing yourself say the same things time and time again. But the truth is, you need to overcome this fatigue because it's your ability to say the same things repeatedly that creates a culture in your organization. You must constantly reinforce your messages and sell your dream to others so they fully understand your mission as a leader. This also reinforces the basic need for certainty in many people. Your messages must be simple so that everyone can clearly understand them. Treat these messages and the number of times you repeat them like a crusade. All successful entrepreneurs are this way. When you meet them, you know exactly what they're about. Their reputation precedes them. This is the way they build a successful brand. They create pre-existing positive ideas about who they are and what they stand for through ongoing repetition that's memorable and easy to understand. In all cases, whatever outlets you use should be consistent in this repetition. As a business person, your marketing, social media, sales materials, emails, and every other piece of outreach should reinforce your mission. If you want to undermine your efforts, put out confusing and conflicting messages and see how successful you are. Effective parenting also requires repetition. You must constantly express your values, beliefs, and expectations to your children. Don't assume you can say something once and a child will take it in and remember it. As a leader, get to a place where every person you lead can infectiously repeat your message back to you. That makes the people you lead your most significant assets in pursuit of your dreams. 6. Be generous with recognition. Constantly look for ways to recognize people. If you're going to build a great organization, it needs to be predicated on competition and recognizing achievements. All great organizations are competitive. They foster that mindset and acknowledge accomplishments. Recognition is critical. Recognizing people for being one more thinkers and doers is a great form of leadership. Conversely, if you're not creating an environment where competition and recognition are important, you miss out on maximizing potential in business, family, or sports. Effective leaders are great at acknowledging and recognizing people. This leadership principle is so easy to implement, but it's also overlooked way too often. That shouldn't be the case. Remember, as a basic human need, people thrive on recognition to feel significant. I've discovered that while people often equate recognition with significance, what they really want is love. After all, in many people's minds, recognition is a form of love. Remember when we were kids and our parents recognized our efforts when we brought home an A on a test or hit a home run in a ball game? Our need for recognition was a way for us to hope our parents would acknowledge they loved us even more. As adults, we never lose this basic human need. It's hardwired into our DNA. That's why everyone you meet wants to be loved, cared for, believed in, and have you show them how to do better. As a leader, people look up to you. What you say matters. Your words are oversized, and what may seem like a small offhand comment to you can mean all the difference in the world to the people under you. Always find a way to be encouraging. Find ways to praise publicly and privately. There's something incredibly powerful about lifting a person up in front of their peers. There's also an incredible but different kind of power that comes from recognizing someone with a one-on-one, personal, and sincere thank you. As a leader, also be creative with your recognition. Not all of it needs to be based on peer performance. Some of that recognition can be based on executing core principles. You can also acknowledge people who do the small things, like showing up early or showing up to work every day over the course of a year. Awards, plaques, and all manners of verbal or written acknowledgments are highly effective ways of recognizing someone. I like to write personal letters to the children of the mothers and fathers of people who work for me. letting them know how amazing their parents are. This is a form of recognition that almost nobody utilizes. I'm constantly trying to find unique and innovative ways to recognize the people I lead. It's important to create this kind of culture. Remember, one of the six basic needs is significance. See chapter 15. And a key element of that is recognition. Another basic need is love, and when you give people recognition, it extends a form of love to them. 7. Have a cause, crusade, and a mission. Show me any great organization, and I'll show you one that is cause and mission-driven. These places are single-minded and ferociously focused on their end game. As a leader, when you create a mission and convince people to buy into it, this is another form of meeting a basic human need. In this case, that need is contribution. It's also a huge element of being evangelical when people are asked to rally around a cause bigger than themselves. A mission has two components. 1. What are we for? You must define what you believe in and then inspire people to rally around this crusade. What is our mission statement and our core values? What are the elements we believe in, and how do they contribute to us creating a great place to be? 2. What are we against? A mission has to have an enemy. There needs to be something you're against. For example, if you lead a food bank, then you're against hunger. If you own a gym, your enemy could be obesity. Think of it like being part of a sports rivalry, like the Red Sox and Yankees, or the Lakers and the Celtics. Obviously, if you're for one team, then it's a safe bet you're against the other. It's one thing to win a championship, but it goes to the next level when you're playing against your rival. The best enemies are usually something you're trying to eradicate or change. As a director of a women's shelter, you're working to end domestic abuse. If you own a wealth management company, you could be trying to change how people invest money or eliminate bad financial decisions. The stronger or more emotionally driven you make both components, the easier it is to lead those who buy into them. Also, like a leader for any great crusade, you must make it a point to stand in front of your troops and lead them. You must be willing to take the hits. Be visible and vocal that you're willing to shield those under you from criticism or people who want to harm or undermine your efforts. The perks of leadership fall upon you the most, and so should the burdens as well. 8. Be authentic and humble. If you're a liar or a phony, the people you lead may not say it, but they'll know. When it comes to leadership, telling the truth is everything. People will accept that you're not perfect. However, they won't accept that you're not honest. When you make a mistake, don't try to hide it. Acknowledge it. You'd be surprised at how much you endear yourself to people when you simply say, "I made a mistake. I'm sorry. And I'll do better next time." When you can be truthful about your own performance, you can also be truthful about other people's performance. When you're not authentic about yourself, it's very difficult to create an environment of openness. Similarly, when people under you make a mistake, if there's no malice attached, practice compassion, because nobody gets things right all the time. 9. Create a culture. People are drawn to an overall environment. They want a culture where a mission, goals, and expectations are clearly defined. A well-designed culture takes into account all six of the basic needs and how to meet them. Culture creates certainty, love, and growth. Recognition and a sense of contribution build morale and a sense of purpose. Culture is critical because it creates a place where everyone executes their unique geniuses in the present, and everyone also stays focused on the future at the same time. A healthy culture also values transparency. Questions are embraced, not feared. The best companies create cultures because leaders know this allows them to recruit the best employees. Talented employees gravitate to businesses with outstanding cultures because they know tools and resources are in place to help them flourish without negativity or distractions. 10. Give people the resources they need to be successful. There's nothing worse in life than going into a battle with a nagging feeling you don't have enough of what you need to win that battle. As a leader, it's up to you to properly equip your troops so they feel confident about the challenges you're asking them to tackle. If they must worry about what they don't have, you put them at a distinct disadvantage. Properly giving your people the resources they need is the battle you must fight before you ask them to do their part on your behalf. This is not a one-time deal. It needs to be a part of your culture. It needs to be a constant process. Resources are not only about training, coaching, supplies, equipment, tools, and an ample budget. You must also work hard at meeting people's basic human needs. When you understand that some employees need certainty, recognition, or growth opportunities, and you take steps to meet those needs, you are giving your people important resources as well. Also, ask yourself what resources you need to be an effective leader. As a CEO, a parent, a coach, or in any other capacity, you need to make sure not to neglect your own resources and basic human needs. You'll undermine your own effectiveness when you're not able to operate at a peak capacity, too. 11. Build a movement. Many of you listening to this book want to be more than great leaders. You want to build a movement. You want to create a massive change on a large scale. As a reminder, people don't always have to believe what you're saying. They only have to believe that you believe what you're saying. However, you need to be persistent, repetitious, and evangelical in your efforts. Building a movement is a massive and ambitious undertaking. Strong leaders must allow people to see themselves inside the dream, recognize each person's unique gifts, meet people's basic needs, and set an inspirational example to have a chance at a favorable outcome. Building a movement takes time, but that movement will come toppling down like a house of sticks in a hurricane if you don't start by building a solid foundation and use the best available resources at your disposal. Being a one more leader is not easy. But when you learn how to apply these leadership principles over time, you can not only propel your life to the highest level possible, you can also elevate the lives of others that you lead as well. Chapter 17. One more degree of equanimity. Between stimulus and response, there is space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Viktor E. Frankl, neurologist, psychiatrist, Holocaust survivor. To lead a blissful life, you must seek equanimity. In basic terms, equanimity is achieving serenity and mental calmness in a world filled with stressors. But it's much more than that. Equanimity is the quiet glue that underpins a lot of the other ideas in this book. To reach the highest level of these strategies, you must do so with an advanced degree of equanimity. I am a strong proponent of equanimity, and I think you should be too. The essence of equanimity. Equanimity originates from the Latin word equanimitas, having an even mind. It is the result of combining equus, even, and animus, mind and soul. Searching for an even mind and soul is an elusive virtue. People spend lifetimes in search of equanimity, me included. I've struggled to find calmness throughout my life. For me, finding equanimity is easier in low-stress situations. However, it's a lot more valuable when I can summit it under duress. By better understanding what equanimity is and putting it into practice, my paths to success take less time and are more frequent and substantial. Start with this fact. We can't control the vast majority of what goes on in our lives. We can dream, set standards and goals, and adjust our thinking and actions in a dozen different ways. What we can't do is control outcomes, despite our best efforts. For many people, the natural response is disappointment, frustration, despair, and anger. Nobody is immune from those feelings at one time or another. But what if you could raise your awareness about other ways to condition your brain and your response to outside forces and outcomes? What if you didn't let setbacks negatively impact you? What if you rose above bad outcomes to a positive and rational mental state impervious to those setbacks? This is the essence of equanimity. When faced with a difficult situation, such as a stressful phone call, a poor meeting, a financial setback, or a relationship challenge, the highest achievers can find equanimity when others can't. Why do some elite performers rise to an even higher level in crunch time while others wilt? Equanimity is the invisible separator between super elite performers and those who are average and ordinary. Think of it this way. A lot of pitchers have an easier time striking out batters in the first inning with nobody on base versus facing a home run hitter with the bases loaded in the ninth. Golfers can sink putts all round long on a Thursday of a tournament. But how many can use equanimity to sink a 20-footer on the 18th hole on Sunday to win by a stroke? If you're having a rough patch in your relationship, can you use equanimity to say the right thing that will bring the heat down instead of the wrong thing that will have you packing your bags 10 seconds later? Everyone can find degrees of equanimity most of the time. One of the things that separates them from high achievers is that high achievers can find equanimity when they need it the most. Equanimity is one of the world's oldest philosophies, and its elements are present in many religions. In Christianity, we often look to each other and say, "Peace be with you," or "the peace of Christ be with you." There are countless examples in the Bible. "The Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace." Exodus chapter 14, verse 14. "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do as I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful." John chapter 14, verse 27. "But the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace." Psalm 37, verse 11. Equanimity is also woven into several Eastern Indian religions. For example, Hinduism asks believers to abandon all attachments to success or failure. Elements of yoga teach that equanimity is attainable through regular meditation and mental disciplines that clear the mind and bring it closer to a healthy balance. Judaism places importance on equanimity as a necessary foundation for spiritual and moral development. The Gautama Buddha, a widely followed 5th century BC philosopher and spiritual teacher, described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. A few hundred years after his death, he simply became known as Buddha, which means awakened one or enlightened one. His teachings regarding Buddhism have been widely circulated as the philosophy's foundational beliefs. The Islamic religion has close ties to equanimity as well. The word Islam comes from the Arabic word aslama, which denotes the peace that comes from total surrender and acceptance. Muslims trace this to God's ultimate wisdom, and many take it to mean that being a Muslim is aligned with being in a state of equanimity. Equanimity as a spiritual philosophy is one of humanity's deep-seated pillars. It is a spiritual belief that has been taught and praised for centuries. Before delving deeper into the individual elements of equanimity, it's necessary to recognize how it has been woven into society for millennia. The elements of equanimity. It's one thing to say that you should aim for one more level of equanimity. It's quite another to understand how you should get there. Like any challenge, begin by breaking a big concept like equanimity into smaller parts. That will add clarity and simplicity and make it easier to accept equanimity in its entirety. As you study equanimity and how it relates to your beliefs and religion, some elements may or may not resonate with you. I'm going to give you some overarching principles, but it's up to you to decide how best to approach your version of equanimity in a way that makes the most sense to you. Here are several key points to consider. Equanimity is about finding serenity as you battle the challenges in your life. You're going to get tossed about. That's life, and there's no hiding from it. While we can't control outside forces, we can be mindful of how we think and react to them. This awareness lets us quiet our minds. Serenity is about accepting there are some things we simply can't change. Finding serenity requires practice. Meditation towards equanimity requires you consciously release preferences for or against all things. Your actions are guided more by your values and virtues instead of your desires that are reactions to positive or negative feelings. Equanimity is about recognizing impermanence. No matter what is happening in your life right now, it won't last forever. Life is all about change and impermanence. When you recognize this, you understand that good times and bad will pass through your life. Clinging to the good or the bad can only lead to pain. It's easy to understand how hanging on to the bad creates pain, but recognize that when you hang on to the good, it can also be a source of pain when it leaves. Equanimity is about doing away with permanence and the pain associated with it. Equanimity creates a space of awareness and lets every piece of stimulation come and go. Thoughts are just thoughts. Sounds are only sounds. People are just being themselves. And events are only events. Equanimity reminds us of our insignificance. We often place way too much focus on ourselves. When we're able to come to grips that we're only one small part of the vast human condition, it liberates us from the pressures we place on ourselves. Our fears shrink when we put them into perspective. We don't run from pain or avoid blame or loss with such vigor. We accept our state and work towards balance in our lives with added calmness. Equanimity is about letting go. If a challenge or setback in your life is heavy, set it down. Let it go. Learn how to detach from negative beliefs, resentment, pain, and hurt. One of the Four Noble Truths proclaimed by Buddha is that attachment is the origin of suffering. The attachment to desire or the attachment to desire not to have something both create anxiety and fear. Letting go of both and accepting what comes into your life, good and bad, release us from a prison of our thoughts. Ajahn Chah, a 20th century Thai Buddhist monk, summarized it well when he said, "If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will have complete peace." Equanimity embraces change. Instead of getting stuck in the status quo, recognize that your future lies in the winds of change. Acceptance of change, which is inevitable, brings about peace. Fighting change is a waste of time. These concepts only scratch the surface of what equanimity is. If you're interested, I strongly encourage you to dig deeper. There are whole libraries on equanimity and how it is a fixture in so many cultures and religions. The more you know about equanimity, the greater your potential for one more level of equanimity in your life. As part of our further exploration, looking at 8 worldly winds is an excellent place to start. The 8 worldly winds. Buddhism has identified 4 sets of opposing states that exist in our lives. They are called the 8 worldly winds, sometimes known as the 8 worldly dharmas. They appear with various labels but are generally accepted as pleasure and pain, praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disgrace. The goal of equanimity is to lessen the effects these winds have on your mind that occur to one extent or the other every day. Examples of the 8 worldly winds might be: we fall madly in love, only to find out our lover has cheated on us. Our success can be exciting, but it could also lead us to arrogance. We get a big promotion at work, only to have the company declare bankruptcy 6 months later. We root hard for a sports hero or a famous musician and then discover they have a severe drug problem, a criminal past, or they unexpectedly pass away, such as Kobe Bryant did. We must balance good and bad so that while we recognize the good news, we also understand it isn't permanent. We accept that the world will balance things over time. In this way, we neither need to get too high or too low when we react to these events. This isn't to say we shouldn't feel joy or happiness when something good happens. We just need to put it into perspective. Equanimity allows us to do that. Without equanimity as a governor, going back and forth is exhausting. The goal is complete mental calmness. Sometimes we can reach that state, but since the pursuit of equanimity is a lifelong venture, we must refine our approach and course correct as we go along. All 8 worldly winds are teachers. From a spiritual point of view, we need all 8 in our lives. Without one half of the pair, the other ceases to exist or carries no meaning. However, too much preoccupation with the 8 worldly winds is considered a barrier to equanimity. Being too caught up in them creates emotional instability. Equanimity attempts to steer a course down the middle of each of these pairs. It does not entirely fall in line with one side or the other. Equanimity accepts the reality of each wind without following it. The realization is that winds are not permanent, and when they change, it's easier to respond with more flexibility. All of this philosophy is well and good. However, you must decide what your relationship is with equanimity now and in the future. Your relationship with equanimity. When it comes to equanimity, people generally fall into one of 4 categories: aggressive and with equanimity, aggressive and lacking equanimity, passive with equanimity, passive and lacking equanimity. Of these, there's only one ideal state you should target: aggressive and with equanimity. If you're passive, equanimity won't help you much, other than to be a nagging part of your brain that reminds you that you're too laid back and calm to accomplish anything significant in your life. You must bring a certain level of tenacity to your life. You don't have to turn the dial up to 10 at all times, but you must lead a life where you get stuff done. I mentioned at the beginning of this chapter that I haven't always approached life with enough equanimity. I admit that I was such a hard charger that I threw my life out of balance, and I didn't even know it at the time. Sure, I got stuff done. I made a lot of money, but I paid a higher price than I needed by not practicing equanimity for many years. The journey to equanimity does not happen overnight. As I learned, it requires years of being mindful and intentional in your thoughts and actions. One More thinkers also understand equanimity is not permanent. It's fleeting and will come and go as various challenges occur in your life. You will move between degrees of equanimity from day to day and moment to moment. My goal is to make sure you don't go through life without enough equanimity as I did. Find peace and mental calmness as soon as you can. Your relationship with equanimity is the force that makes many other good things possible in life. Chapter 18. One More Prayer. The first gulp from the glass of natural sciences will make you an atheist, but at the bottom of the glass, God is waiting. Werner Heisenberg. Can you see faith? Can you touch, taste, or smell it? Of course not. But for eons, faith has remained the single most dominant and driving force in man's search for spiritual peace and truth. I know that faith is a highly personal choice for everyone. I respect people of all faiths and the freedom to pursue that faith in whatever way brings the most meaning to each of you in your own lives. Having said that, I wouldn't be writing a book that's true to myself if I didn't share with you the significant impact my faith as a Christian has had on my life. In fact, it's had the biggest impact of anything on my life. Quite frankly, I've struggled writing this chapter, not because of the deep belief in my faith, but because I want to share with you the huge impact I know prayer can have on your life. I also want to be transparent about my love of Jesus. Having said that, I also want to be respectful of your beliefs and not push you away by preaching. This is not a chapter about religion. This is a chapter about using prayer and faith as a strategy to help you achieve your goals. And even if faith doesn't play a big role in your life, keep listening, because I'm also going to tell you how I think science can impact your life in this area as well. That leads us to a fundamental question. What is faith? We know faith moves mountains, but that only begins to scratch the surface of what faith truly is. Faith is universal. Every civilization since the beginning of time has practiced some sort of faith-based spirituality. It's also fair to say that prayer is the manifestation of faith. Faith and prayer combine to give you the paths to peace, truth, conviction, and living by a moral code. They go hand in hand, but each is uniquely different and they exist in harmony for your benefit. In one more terms, approach faith as your thoughts. Approach prayers as your actions. When you combine them, they form a bond unlike anything else. That's why it's important to think about your faith often and then act by committing to prayer often too. Most people are driven by some form of faith that is strengthened and confirmed by prayers. Prayers strengthen your faith-based beliefs. In turn, that defines your character, what you think about yourself, and how you treat others. In fact, I can attest that one more prayer has drawn me closer to Jesus every day of my life. Consciously and subconsciously, you pray more than you realize. You may not always view it as prayer, but your mind's natural tendency is to think about what you want in life. You see them as desires, but in reality, desires are a form of prayer. When you desire a job promotion, a happy and loving relationship, good health, or wealth, whether you realize it or not, you're engaging in a form of prayer. That leads to several questions. Are you praying often enough? Is prayer a regular part of your daily activities? Do you only pray when you need your God's help? How often do you give intentional thought to what it is you pray about? Are you practicing gratitude when you pray and after your prayers are answered? How do you define faith and prayer? Just as every person has a unique relationship with their God, faith and prayer take on a highly personal meaning for every one of us. Consider how the Bible defines faith in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. While there are universal truths and beliefs we can all agree on, when it comes to defining faith and prayer, we hold some thoughts based on how we perceive faith, prayer, and our relationship with a higher being. The presence of faith and the ability to pray are unique to humankind. Our ability to think conceptually above and beyond what we see, touch, and feel in the world separates us from other living beings. Free will means that we can interpret faith on a personal level. From that interpretation, we can pray on a personal level as well. Faith has applications beyond those associated with religion. Faith relies on trust and loyalty to a duty, person, or thing. And in broad terms, faith is based on accepting a proposed truth absent proof of the truth. Prayer is more narrowly defined. For many people, the purpose of prayer is to increase our understanding of what our God calls good while also increasing desire in us for what is good. So defining faith in prayer essentially means trusting that these things are intended to cultivate the good in us. Often, people resist embracing faith because they feel like they need to know everything about a particular faith before feeling comfortable doing so. For some of you, that type of thinking not only applies to faith, but to all parts of your life. What do I mean by this? If you feel you need to reach a certain threshold of knowledge before moving forward with something, you become paralyzed by inaction and fall behind those who are more willing than you to step into the unknown and act anyway. To live a full life, there must be several times when you suspend the necessity of needing to know everything before you act. This is especially true with faith because we're never going to know everything there is to know about faith. By its very definition, faith precludes this type of thinking. Does this limited thinking hold you back not only in your faith, but in other areas of your life? For example, suppose you're the type of person who needs to know everything there is to know before jumping into action. In that case, chances are you're never going to be the person who risks starting their own business or entering a new romantic relationship. A need to know everything in advance belief system will not serve you well throughout your life. Every area of our lives, especially faith, depends on stepping into the unknown to some degree or another. Drawing strength from my faith and prayers. I'm often asked what my favorite book is, and for me, there has always been only one answer, the Bible. And my favorite scripture is Philippians chapter 4, verse 13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I am fortified every time I read the Bible. I also have a deep and ongoing curiosity about the nature of humanity, profound spiritual questions, and moral questions that have challenged me to find answers for many years now. One of the ways I draw strength is through a simple passage that sums up the simplicity and purity of being faithful and praying often. In John chapter 16, verse 24, Jesus said, "Ask, and you will receive, and your joy will be complete." That is the essence of faith and prayers and the impact it has had on my life. More than that, because I believe fully in the power of faith and prayer, I am never alone. Throughout my entire life, I've drawn considerable strength from the positive impact of faith and prayers. That has given me supreme confidence every time I walk into a sales call, step on a stage at a public speaking event, or when I'm simply out and about meeting and talking to people on the street. I have been rewarded through my faith and prayers too. I firmly believe there is a direct correlation between the wealth I've achieved, the business relationships and friendships I've been blessed with, and most importantly, the ongoing and blissful family life I enjoy. It's difficult to explain the feeling that faith and prayers have on you to someone who does not practice these things regularly. I can only give witness to what these things have done for me. I believe, if practiced correctly, faith and prayers should be used as a time to search for inner peace, to reflect on the nature of your life, and to practice gratitude for the gifts you have been given. I draw strength from the calmness that results. This helps center and focus me on what comes next, and from there I can find purpose and energy when it's time to move forward with various parts of my life. Linking faith, energy, and quantum science. People often ask me if my deep belief in faith means I can't also believe in science. Absolutely not! Quite the contrary! There are three philosophies related to the fundamental nature of life as we know it. 1. Some people consider themselves incredibly faith-based. 2. Others think of themselves as energy-based. 3. Finally, others are science-based. I'm somewhat unique because I consider myself a member of all three camps. I'm a Christian, but I also believe I have an almighty God who created the universe. I'm a huge believer in science and energy as well. In no way do I think that these doctrines conflict with each other. At one point, I used to think that what I believed about science meant that I had to reduce the depths of my beliefs in my faith. Conversely, I also thought that I had to discount many scientific principles as a way of maintaining my strong faith-based beliefs. However, as I've read and learned more, I've come to realize that science has actually confirmed my beliefs in the complexities, beauty, and the marvelous nature of my faith. My Almighty God, He created everything, or He did not. The basic definition of quantum science is that the universe is filled with particles that interact with each other and flow with quantum energy. This scientific explanation of this energy is referred to as the study of quantum physics. What I love about quantum energy is that this is where faith and science intersect. In fact, some of my most devout friends of all faiths, including pastors, rabbis, imams, priests, and others, are very much into the idea of energy. My belief in these three ideas stems from a probing question I asked myself long ago. By knowing a God exists who put trees, animals, oceans, gravitational fields, weather, and all the other things in our world, why can't that God be the same creator of the energy we all feel and experience in the world? Despite the enormity of this question, by accepting the premise that energy is felt by all of us and that God is the creator of this energy, that is far less monumental than God creating the complexity of man and woman. To me, creating an energy field pales in comparison to giving 7 billion people the ability to think, question, express emotions, and challenge reason and ponder the great questions of our world. Most important, He gave us the gift of finding answers to many of those questions, propelling us forward as a civilization since time began. This is in addition to the biological miracles that give each of us the essence of life. Consider God's miracle of procreation. The transfer of oxygen in our bodies to sustain life, processing food and water into energy, the gifts of sight, sound, taste, and other amazing sensory experiences we use to navigate the world. Think about that for a moment. Truly let the question sink in as to why and how you came to exist. Not only do I believe faith, energy, and science exist to give us answers, peace, logic, order, and whatever we need in our lives, I know each of these elements exist because I've personally experienced them time and time again. I've been fascinated for a long time by the unseen energy in our world, how it folds into my faith, and how I pray. At first glance, it doesn't seem that faith and science have anything in common. However, it may surprise you to learn that spiritual leaders and scientists have sought ways to link the two for a long time now. Quantum physics makes the argument that everything can be broken down into infinitesimal particles and waves, creating unseen energy that drives the universe. Just like faith, quantum-sized particles can't be seen, but scientists and religious scholars operate under the assumption that both have a significant influence on humanity. One of the basic tenets of quantum physics is the belief that you are creating an answer to a question by making a decision. Faith operates the same way. Additionally, if you have made another decision or used another method, the truth you settled on might have ended up looking very different. Faith leads you to certain answers. Those answers create decisions and outcomes. Can you see the link of how science and spirituality are connected? Isn't this how faith and prayer guide us to the right decisions? That interconnectedness helps strengthen the argument for the importance of understanding the unseen energy of faith and the core practice of prayer. The intersection of science and faith has become an increasingly cutting-edge area of study as humanity continues to question the most profound elements of our very existence. The essence of the link between faith and energy is this. Many people believe that if they embrace faith and prayer, they must then exclude the concept of energy in the universe. I believe just the opposite is true. Believing in energy and quantum science strengthens my faith and my purposeful prayers. They feed off each other instead of excluding each other. The more you pray, the more often people will feel your energy, peace, comfort, and empathy. For that reason, regardless of your faith or what you believe, I recommend you pray more often. You are always making people feel something. Have you ever been around someone and immediately felt attracted or not attracted to them? I know you will have met several people in your life where you just instantly hit it off with them because of the way they made you feel. Believe it or not, that's part of quantum physics. That is part of the unseen energy of the world. The same unseen energy exists in other ways. Would you agree with me that there's an energy force that keeps your feet on the ground, and it's called gravity? Have you ever walked into a room and felt a peaceful energy while you were there? Conversely, have you ever walked into a place and the energy did not sit well with you? Maybe it scared you or made you feel uncomfortable. Here's another excellent example. Have you ever noticed how dogs immediately take to some people, but others can't get within 10 feet of them or they risk getting bitten? This is a perfect example of how the energy you emit says certain things about you as well. Your ability to be intentional and make people feel or not feel certain things is critical in achieving the things in your life that you dream about. Remember this, you are always making people feel something. There is an energy that attracts certain things to your life and an energy that also repels things away from you as well. If you have an absence of understanding of how this energy works, you are creating a considerable disservice to yourself. However, having a good understanding of this concept will serve you well in your life. The depths to which you decide to explore this energy in quantum physics are entirely up to you. But to deny its existence is to reject something as fundamental as gravity in our world. My understanding of this energy and how it works has been critical to my success for many years now. I'm also keenly aware of the vast majority of the people I meet are entirely oblivious to the type of energy they emit and how they make people feel. Your ability to control and harness the energy you put out is critical to how well you function in the world. Also, understand that sometimes the energy you need to put out is loving, sometimes intense, and sometimes understanding. This is the other part of using your energy to its fullest advantage. The power of one more prayer. As I've already mentioned, but I want to stress again, faith and prayers are highly personal, and I respect every person and how they choose to practice these things. I'm happy to share what I know and believe, and if these things make sense to you and help you achieve a higher degree of faith and more focused prayers, that will make me happy. I firmly believe that one more prayer will draw you closer to your personal faith in whatever form that faith is. Here are some of the additional things I believe about faith and one more prayer. The stronger your faith is in whatever you believe, the deeper your commitment to your resulting cause will be. In strategic terms, think of it this way. If you have faith and you pray that you're the right person for a job promotion, or that you deserve to land a big deal because you have faith, you are the right fit to solve another person or a company's problem, the harder you're going to work to make that become a reality. At times, your faith will waver, and there will be times in your life when you have questions for your God. You must ask these questions and test your faith. Unless you get answers, or at least go searching for them, you'll never strengthen your faith. You must remove doubt as you encounter it. Don't pray only when it suits you. Pray every day. Be consistent. Make it every bit the habit that exercising, eating the right foods, or telling your spouse or children that you love them is for you. You've heard the expression, there are no atheists in a foxhole. Don't wait until you're a foxhole of your own. Pray in good times and in bad. Pray with honesty. Pray with intention. Do not simply go through the motions when you pray, no matter what shape your life is in. Make sure your prayers and your requests are congruent with the will of your God. This truth is explicitly stated in 1 John chapter 5, verse 14. If we ask anything according to His will, He hears us. Don't pray for harm or ill will upon anyone. It's not acceptable, ever. I also believe the power of prayer has a compounding effect on your life. The longer you build faith and prayer into an essential part of your life, the more impact it will have on you and the people who matter most to you as well. Another thing I have learned is that when tragedy strikes, you may have a crisis of faith. But I have also learned that is when you need faith and your prayers the most. And finally, at times, others will challenge you or ostracize you for your faith and how you pray. They may not stop long enough to understand your beliefs, or they may generalize based on their own beliefs and quite possibly their own shortcomings. My response to people like that is that your relationship with your God is more important than what people think they know and assume about you. If you can place your God first, then you are well on your way to effectively incorporating faith and the power of one more prayer into your life. Chapter 19. One Last, One More. I've had many epiphanies since I started writing The Power of One More. However, one of them stands above all others. I realize my life and business philosophy comes from my relationship with my hero and my father, Edward Joseph Mylett Jr. My belief that people can change and the reason I'm in the field of helping other people do better in life is because the man I love and looked up to above all others did just that. Although I've shared several things with you, none is more essential or difficult for me to write about than One Last, One More. When you watch the person you're closest to in life live a certain way and then commit to a profound change when faced with one last one more, it not only changes them, it changes you too. Over the course of his lifetime, this is the story of how my father taught me one of life's most priceless lessons. I know you'll find value in it too. The lesson of one last one more begins here. My father was a banker by profession, a hard-working man who never missed a day at work. He was also an alcoholic for the first 15 years of my life. He paid a horrible price as he suffered through this disease, and by extension, the people he loved paid a steep price too. We became the collateral damage in a war that raged inside of him. Although we had a very loving family, his illness created anxiety and worry in all of us. It was tough to watch my father struggle every day with something I knew he wanted to rid from himself. But ironically, I will tell you, his drinking happened for me and not to me. Even more so, my father's alcoholism happened for him and not to him. That's because through his illness, my father eventually found his true calling in life. His drinking happened for me because most of the skills I use to this day are because I was raised by an alcoholic father. For example, I learned to read body language, tonality, and facial expressions as a young boy. I first developed it by learning how to read which father would come home from work. Would it be a sober and loving father or an intoxicated and detached father? I got to a point where I could figure this out by how my dad would insert a key into our front door lock. If he struggled and fumbled to get the key in the lock, I knew he had been drinking. Conversely, when the key slid into the lock without hesitation, I knew what that meant as well. Once inside, I paid attention to how he talked and walked, his body language, demeanor, and attitude. It was always a guessing game as to whether I would avoid him until he went to bed or would I go out and play catch with him in the backyard. When you're 8 years old and this is a skill you need to have for a better home life, you learn from that lesson quickly and you learn it well. Although deep down my father was a kind-hearted man, while he was drinking, his actions didn't always align with his character. Many times he was not only emotionally removed from the rest of us, but he was physically removed from time to time as well. There were days and nights when he wouldn't come home. And we all knew the reason why. Despite this affliction, my father was my best friend, and I looked up to him. He was my hero, confidant, advisor, and the person I trusted above all others. He made me and my three sisters feel special, and we all thought about him in the same way. Despite challenges in your own families, I know many of you have experienced the things my sisters and I did. As a young boy, every son starts out thinking his father is perfect, someone who can do no wrong. Unfortunately, the nature of life is that a father is human and he will make mistakes along the way. As a father now, I know I certainly have made them. But when you're a young boy, and if you're like I was, you stand in awe of your father. You gladly make him your hero, and you look beyond those mistakes and imperfections. However, I didn't look up to him because I thought he was perfect. In fact, the opposite was true. It was his ability to overcome his mistakes and shortcomings that made him even more extraordinary in my eyes. I'll never know exactly why my dad turned to drinking, and I don't think any of us ever figured out why it became an addiction for him. Difficult, challenging, and tragic things happen to everyone, which means that there will come a time in your life when these things happen to you. Like it or not, the clock will run out, and no amount of praying, wishing, or begging will deny this inevitability. One of the immutable laws of the universe is that everything comes with an expiration date. Let that sink in for a moment. Sooner or later, everything ends. No matter who you are or what you're going through, change will come to you. This is not meant to depress you. It's meant to create a sense of urgency in you. It's also to remind you that things are happening for you and not to you. At several times in your life, you'll reach the end of a journey, and you'll come face to face with one last one more. In these times, you'll make choices that define your character and change the course of your life. Your world changes when you realize your days on earth are finite. Many people come to this realization earlier than others, and some are acutely aware of it but can't break free from those heavy chains they've forged. At some point, we're all bound together by one last one mores. We can't run from them, so we must learn to face them the best possible way. Learn to live your life the best way you know how before those days come. You can't stop or slow down the march of time and those inevitable changes. All you can do is make the most of what you have right now. In this way, you can intentionally guide your fate. It's how you can live life with fewer burdens, regrets, anger, and sadness. And yes, it's not easy. Change rarely is. When I was 15, my dad was confronted with the biggest one last one more of his life. My mother gave him an ultimatum. Either you get sober or lose your family. You won't get another chance, she told him. I'll never forget what my dad said to me when faced with this. Eddie, I'm going to go away for a while, and I'm going to stop drinking. When I come back, you're going to have the father you deserve, your sisters are going to have the dad they deserve, and your mother is going to have a husband worthy of her. I had heard this before, and I wanted desperately to believe him, so I asked him, how is this time going to be any different? I've never seen my dad cry before, but that day, with tears in his eyes, he said, I have one more chance, Eddie. One last one more. My father, who struggled with his addiction and tried to get sober many times before, took those words to heart. The stakes were now so high that one more failure was no longer an option. Here's the lesson I took from that and what I want to share with you. Linking huge emotional reasons to what you want to accomplish is the key to why you must be willing to go through the difficult struggles associated with change. Those reasons to change must be overwhelmingly more significant than the obstacles you face, so that those obstacles are dwarfed in comparison. If you show me somebody with big enough reasons to change in their life, I'll show you somebody capable of making that change. I'm often asked, where can you find those reasons? You need to look no further than your dreams or the other people in your life. For my father, the tough challenge of getting and staying sober was nowhere near as significant as the reason to change, which was the catastrophic possibility of losing his family. To him, as a devoted and loving family man, there was no more significant loss than taking his family away from him. Until that time, my father was a man who had not lived up to a life he was capable of living. He knew it. He also knew he had to change, and he did. My father didn't go looking for redemption when he got sober, but that's exactly what he found. Part of this redemption is revealed in this book. Although I'm writing it, the things you've heard about are a shared legacy with him. I'm often asked how I got into the business of helping others. It wasn't by accident. It was because of my father. The power of one more is a direct result of my father's influence on me. My desire to help others reflects my father's determination to devote his life to helping others after he got sober. Through his work with Alcoholics Anonymous, my father embraced the idea of living one more day sober, a common mantra of AA. In fact, it became the entire premise of his life. That may sound like a small thing to overcome if you've never battled addiction, but in the world of an alcoholic, winning this fight one more day at a time means everything. Once he committed to it, my dad didn't try to stay sober every remaining day of his life. He tried to stay sober one more day of his life, one day at a time, stacked upon each other until days became weeks and months and they became years. The difference in that kind of mindset means everything to a recovering alcoholic. If you're listening to this and you're thinking about quitting on your dream, a business you started, or anything important to you, don't put the pressure on yourself to meet that goal for 5 or 10 years or the rest of your life. Instead, think about not quitting for one more day. Take things one more small step at a time. Make your goal of not quitting manageable and easier to achieve. All you need to do is get through today. Tomorrow you can start again and conquer your battles with a one last one more mentality. In your darkest and most challenging times, I know many of you think about quitting and giving up. When those thoughts occur to you, just hold on for one more day. Don't quit for one more day. As I mentioned, for the longest time, I didn't fully realize the entire premise of my life came from my father, his attempts to get sober and his belief in one last one more. But that's exactly how he lived the final 35 years of his life. It bears repeating because one last one more is the lesson of this book. My dad had suffered from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, for several years, but still managed to get around well most of the time. And then one day he started laboring heavy during one of our golf rounds. A month later, he was diagnosed with liposarcoma, a rare type of cancer that develops in fatty tissues and can grow anywhere in your body. Shortly after that, my dad underwent a 12-hour surgery to remove a tumor the size of a football in his chest. He never complained through the surgeries, chemotherapy, radiation, medications, and other treatments that followed. He hid the severity of his illness from us, knowing we would be upset if we knew how much he was suffering. My father battled his cancer for 9 long years before passing away from related respiratory complications on October 30th, 2020. Less than a year ago as I write this, he was 72 years old. There is a crushing void in my life where he used to be. I miss him like no other, and I still struggle with not having him around. I long for our conversations and the time we spent together. While I expect the hole where he was in my life to get smaller over time, deep down I know I will continue to miss him every day I remain on this earth. The magic of time is that it allows us to heal and reflect, and that's precisely what I've done since my father's passing. It's an ongoing process, but I've been able to put some perspective on his life and how all of us can take away important lessons from who Edward Joseph Milet Jr. was and who he continues to be. These are three things I want you to know about One Last One More. 1. Live a One Last One More life as often as you can. 2. One Last One More works best when you treat every day as a new life. 3. Understand that it's never too late for one last one more. When you live a one last one more life as often as you can, you approach life with a high degree of urgency. What if you were only allowed one last one more dance with the person you love? What if you could only have one last one more conversation with your children? What would you say to them, and how would you say it? Think about your life if you only had one last one more chance to tell your spouse that you love them. Consider how you would act if, like my father, you were given one last one more chance to be the parent, the sibling, the child, or the friend you always wanted to be. When you approach life with a one last one more mentality, your priorities become clear. You are more grateful for God's gifts that have been given to you. You respect and appreciate time, and you will become a better human being. Here's the best example I can tell you of how one last one more impacted my relationship with my dad. My father and I loved to play golf. When I was a young man, we would play rounds at El Prado Golf Course in Chino, California. For us, it became our haven, a place where we could go to unwind, laugh, and share our thoughts and problems with each other. We had lively discussions about politics all the time. We would talk about spirituality, the meaning of life, and about his children and grandchildren. In our quieter moments, he'd reflect on some of the regrets in his life, mainly about the chances he didn't take. Although he was proud of me, my dad always stressed that while my business success was beyond admirable, he made sure I understood my relationships with my family and friends are what mattered most. He cared little about the houses I owned, my wealth, or the other trappings of success. Instead, he was more concerned about the man I was, how I treated people, what difference I was making in the world, and whether I was living a good and virtuous life. What he valued remains one of the most important lessons he ever taught me. It has kept me grounded to this day. Our talks were deep, and over the years, he became the only person who knew everything about me. Even as I approached 50 years old, he was the person I called for advice. In fact, my dad was the only person I ever called for advice. He was also the first person I called whenever something happened, good or bad. As my career took off and I started to enjoy a measure of success, I wanted to give my dad the gift of playing one of the finest golf courses in the world. So around the Christmas holidays, for many years, the two of us would travel to Pebble Beach for an annual father-son golf getaway. It was a small measure of thanks for all he had given to me, and those times are among the most meaningful moments of my life. Whether it was playing at El Prado or Pebble Beach, these trips were not so much about golf as they were about spending time together. It could have just as easily been going fishing, turning wrenches on a classic car, taking in a ball game, or whatever common interest fathers and sons enjoy together. Although I had grown into a man, I needed my dad as much as ever. As a father with my own challenges, my dad provided wise counsel and a place I could go for life advice, as only a father can. I miss so many things about my dad, but I miss these golf outings the most. Always had a sense of how important they were, but now that my father is gone, they've taken on a whole new level of meaning. Make no mistake, it's not the golf I miss. It's the hours I spend with him, just sharing time. I would give anything for one more round of golf with my dad. Many times I still can't believe he's gone. Months after he passed, I spoke to an audience of several thousand people, and I couldn't wait to get off the stage to call my dad. Like past conversations, I was excited to go over what went well and what I could have done better. It wasn't until the adrenaline left my body and I was standing backstage by myself that I realized I couldn't do that any longer. I can't tell you how many times I've had the same initial rush and awkward feeling since my dad's passing, but I can tell you with certainty that the clarity of what one last one more means in all parts of my life has never been greater. If you take nothing else away from this book, I'm telling you now, if you have someone in your life who means a lot to you, start living your life with a one last one more mentality toward them. Cherish every moment you spend together and live your life in ways that will make them proud and make you happy. Don't wait. My father would be embarrassed if he thought this book was about him. For his sake and mine, it's not. This book is about you and your families, your soul, your relationship with others, and the legacies you're creating. I'm only using my relationship with my father to help you understand why living a one last one more life is the urgent frame of mind you need to live your best life. The second thing I want you to understand is that to fully appreciate one last one more, treat every day as a new life. There are no guarantees. You or someone you care about can be here one moment and gone the next. You are blessed every second you're alive, and you need to approach those moments with extreme gratitude. Learn to appreciate things, big and small, and the people God has brought into your life. Release the thoughts and the people that weigh you down. When you let these things go, you'll replace them with opportunities and relationships that were meant for you. Your priorities will change as you cast off the past. Too many people get stuck in the quicksand of their memories, and they drown needlessly in guilt, anger, and stupid grudges that only hurt themselves. Instead, when you wake up in the morning, tell yourself this: every day I am alive, I am reborn. When you let go of your past, you create space for the here and now. You can bring energy and enthusiasm to the fleeting nature of one last one mores into your life. You can direct your energy to what matters and not things that will destroy your inner well-being and your relationships with others. When you treat every day as a new life, you'll find more enjoyment and bliss in the things that serve you well. If you must have a one last one more conversation with someone, one last hug before a goodbye, or one last dance before someone you care about goes away, you can do so with a clear mind, free from the mental garbage that gets in the way of living your best life. Don't spoil today by lugging that garbage around. Instead, toss it away and get on with the things that matter. The third and final thing to know is that it's never too late for one last one more. After my father died, I came across several index cards as I was putting away some of his things. On these cards were scribbled codes like 14JL and 13PT. They were scattered on his vanity unit and taped to his bathroom mirror. These codes were dates and the initials of someone's name, and there were hundreds of them. I soon figured out that every one of those cards represented a person my dad had helped get sober, and the dates were that person's sobriety anniversary date. Here's the most remarkable part. On those dates, my father would call that person, wish them a happy sobriety birthday, and congratulate them. His message to them was simple: all you must do is stay sober for one more day. He made these calls hundreds of times a year, every year, including in the last days of his life. Even while he was on oxygen, struggling to breathe, and could barely whisper, he still reached out and made calls to the people on his note cards. Although he was in severe pain and agony, and he knew he would pass away soon, my father had to help one more person. Nobody was watching. Nobody would have known whether he made those calls or not. However, because my father lived a one more life, this was an opportunity for him to help one last one more human being. In the end, my father's one last one more was a phone call to another person in need shortly before he passed away. I've never been so moved or prouder of my dad. His quiet, kind, and humble gestures remain a profound example of service to others that I may never match. Now you know why I've made it my sincere mission to try and help as many people as possible in my life too. I do it to honor my father. Coming back from the brink of losing his family and everything he worked for, my father found purpose and redemption. He made the most of one more chance he was given. Our physical being dies and we do pass from this earth at some point, but my father's one more legacy will live through the ages. We should all be so lucky to live our lives that well. God, in his infinite wisdom, gave us the power of forgiveness. Take this gift to heart. If you have a challenging relationship with someone you care about, find a way to set your differences aside. You simply don't know what comes next. When you find it in your heart to make one more a priority in your life, not only will you lighten the chains of another person, but you'll lighten your chains in life as well. As I watched my father take his final breaths, it dawned on me that one day we'll all face our one more. Our last year on earth, our last month, last week, and our last day, our last hour, and all too soon, our final breath. You can't control the end, but you can control the story in between. Your ability to live your best life is going to be shaped in large part by the one mores I've revealed to you in this book. These thoughts and actions will build the story of your life so that when you do take one last breath, you can be proud of the life you've lived. Don't wait for one more to find you. Go after them with urgency and purpose. You'll unlock the most difficult and essential one more lesson you can learn when you do this. And in doing so, you may just unlock the secret to life itself. About the author. Ed Milet is a highly successful entrepreneur who has blended his unique experiences with a diverse set of practical strategies that have made him one of the most sought-after inspirational speakers in the world today. As a young man, he attended the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California, where he was a 3-time academic All-American before an untimely injury ended his dream of playing in the major leagues. At his father's urging, Ed became a counselor for disadvantaged children in what turned out to be one of the most pivotal turning points of his life. It was there he first started to appreciate the importance of serving others and laying the foundation for success principles he would put into practice later in life. Ed is a serial entrepreneur who has enjoyed considerable success in part through his unrivaled work ethic and ability to fire up people with his dynamic, high-octane presentations. Over the years, he has been involved in several tech, real estate, medical, and food ventures, among many others, leading him to be named a Success Magazine Success 125 Most Influential Leader in 2022. With a strong desire to help people, Ed began sharing his inspirational and performance strategies live and online. In 4 short years, he amassed more than 2 million Instagram followers, wrote a best-selling book, and launched a popular weekly podcast, The Ed Milet Show. Ed thoroughly enjoys engaging with his followers and is active on several social media platforms where his posts are viewed several million times each month. As a keynote speaker, Ed has spoken to millions of people. He is equally adept at delivering relatable strategies in intimate gatherings to arenas filled with 50,000 people or online audiences in the hundreds of thousands. He is well known for combining spirituality, faith, the inner workings of the mind, and tactical thoughts and actions to help people produce real changes in their lives. Ed remains humble about his success, attributing his good fortune to his faith in God, his mentors, and the lessons his father taught him throughout life. In his free time, Ed is an avid golfer, health, and weightlifting enthusiast. He and his wife, Christiana, are the proud parents of 2 adult children. You've been listening to The Power of One More by Ed Milet. Narrated by Ed Milet. Copyright 2022 by John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated. Published by arrangement with John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated. Recording copyright 2022 by Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books. If you've enjoyed this audiobook, please visit rbmediaglobal.com/ascent-audio, where you'll find a wide selection of our unabridged titles. Thank you for being an Ascent Audio listener.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.